From rapid flooding to a slow and painful drought, from South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Friday, August 20th, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, in 2019, when we last spoke with Kurt Ulmer, the Jim River near his operation was cresting at more than 18 feet, 5 feet over the flood level. Today's measurement, fewer than 4 feet. We talk with South Dakota farmers and producers who have gone from flood to drought. SDPB's Richard Tubels joins us to talk about a new trial that explores the power of COVID booster shots. We talk with longtime journalist Kevin Wooster about the Catholic conscience and COVID vaccines. Plus, Music Matters with Nur D. That's coming later in the hour. We're broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
With South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Laura Johnson. Members of the Oglala Sioux Tribe Ambulance Service are planning a walkout today if their demands for changes are not made by the Oglala Sioux Tribe. The tribe's ambulance service employees released their plan about the walkout on Facebook and have submitted a list to the tribal council on ways to improve working conditions. Employees feel they put their lives and well-being at risk to care for residents across the Pine Ridge Reservation. They have given tribal leaders until midnight tonight as a deadline. The tribe's president, Kevin Killer, responded on Facebook stating that the tribe's Health and Human Services Committee will continue to meet with the director of the ambulance service and discuss solutions. A South Dakota man has family members trapped in Afghanistan. He worries about their safety with Taliban control on the country. Salab Naimi says he talks to his relatives when he can.
The Taliban are like, they're shooting, like right now, they're shooting people on the streets in Afghanistan, in their city that my family lives. Even like the girls even cannot go out to go to the shop or anything like that. Everything is bad. So my family are like, they feel like they're dead. And they're calling me and I'm talking to them, but there's nothing I can, like, I don't know how to help them.
Naimi says there are thousands of people in Afghanistan, like his family members, who need help. He worked as an interpreter for the U.S. Army for 4 years and became an American citizen in July. The White House is nominating Native American Charles James III as director of the National Park Service. Sams is an enrolled member of the Cayuse and Walla Walla tribes. They're part of the Confederation tribes of the Umatilla Reservation in Washington and Oregon. If confirmed by the Senate, he will be the first Native American to serve as director of the National Park Service. Sams has 25 years of experience working in tribal and state governments and the nonprofit and conservation fields. The Department of Corrections plans to spend $3.1 million on temporary pay incentives for prison workers. The measures include retention bonuses, higher wages for night shift work, and double wages for voluntary overtime. They last from July 24th through March 2022. Representative Chris Carr says it's important for corrections officials and the legislature to fund permanent pay increases to retain workers once these temporary incentives end.
You set a certain expectation, and it's hard to take away once you've given. Like, that's just the way it is. So I'm just trying to understand kind of, you know, what you're thinking.
The temporary incentives are the result of an anonymous complaint that led to a shakeup and ongoing review of the agency. The complaint says low pay is linked to staff shortages, which cause morale and safety issues. The South Dakota Democratic Party will pay a $7,200 penalty to the Federal Election Commission to settle a probe into its bookkeeping. The FEC found this morning the party engaged in excessive, prohibited, and other impermissible contributions or transfers, mathematical discrepancies, and a series of other violations during the 2017-2018 election cycle. A federal audit also found the party underreported disbursements to the Democratic National Committee by $2.5 million during the 2015-2016 election cycle. The infractions resulted in a shakeup of leadership after they were discovered in 2019. With SDPB, I'm Laura Johnson.
And I'm Lori Walsh. South Dakotans deserve open, honest information from public officials, and we need to communicate with our elected officials in a safe manner, even during a pandemic. U.S. Representative Dusty Johnson has been awarded a Democracy Award from the Congressional Management Foundation. Representative Johnson was selected for achievement in the category of transparency and accountability. He's joining us now from SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City with an update. Congressman Johnson, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Lori.
Congratulations on the award to you and your staff. Tell us a little bit about the Congressional Management Foundation. Who is this award from, and what is its significance?
Yeah, and first off, thanks for mentioning the staff, because they do a lot more of this work to actually earn these things and earn the recognition than I do. So thanks for calling them out. But, you know, the Congressional Management Foundation was founded a number of years ago. There was the thought that there was a gap, that we needed an independent third party, nonpartisan, who would help to coach up some of the staff and operational practices within Congress. And they like to recognize best practices, and that's why they have these awards. We feel really good about it.
Tell me a little bit about some of the challenges, because during the pandemic, you and your staff were figuring out how to have town halls on the phone, the drive-through with Dusty town halls where people were coming up and speaking to you from parking lots. Tell me a little bit about some of the innovations that you put in place in order for people to reach your office and you directly.
Yeah, I mean, clearly with COVID, people's concerns, people's need for to get support from government didn't go away. If anything, it went up. But there were just fewer opportunities. I mean, they couldn't pop into our offices quite as easily. Even if we were open, they might have had concerns. And so we wanted to make sure that we were available, we were accessible. Now, a lot of members of Congress, they hate town halls. They think they are just places where angry people come to yell. I enjoy them. I think they're even if at times they can get a little heated, I think that's a part of what we owe the voters, right? You got to stand and deliver. If I can't sell it, you shouldn't buy it. And so we really were bothered by the fact that this incredibly important American tradition was going to have to skip a year because of COVID. And we just decided we weren't going to let it. So we put on our thinking hats and we said, well, how do you have town halls when you can't get together in large groups? And the drive-through Dusty concept came to the front. And I would we'd, of course, announce it like we do all of our town halls. And I would stand in a vacant parking lot. We would have staffers on the side of the road waving signs, letting folks know that they could pull in. And one-on-one, in a socially distanced way, they could talk to me about their concerns. And, Lori, it was so much fun.
Yeah. What were some of the things that you remember from that time? Because it seems to me that when somebody has that one-on-one opportunity with you, when they feel like they're in their own, you know, their own vehicle, their own space, but yet they might tell you things that you might not have heard otherwise. What sort of things do you remember now hearing from some of those people?
People were really concerned about their kids being out of school. You know, during that first spring, that March, April, May, when the kids were not in school, that people were really, they understood the thought process behind it. But I think even then they could see that this was from the mental, the psychological, the educational. I think they knew there were going to be costs. And I think they really wanted to make sure that the kids were going to be back in school the next year. You know, heard from a lot of people who were in recovery from addiction, who were concerned about how much harder it was for them to stay away from relapse during COVID. And then, of course, we had, you know, government does so many things. And so, Lori, part of what made it a rewarding experience for me is just that every one of these cards would have something different to talk about. Mm-hmm. You know, the unemployment insurance is too high. It's not high enough. We should be doing this overseas. We shouldn't be doing this overseas. It really forced me to, as all town halls do, to be on my toes.
Yeah. This award has been said, you know, as important by the Congressional Management Foundation for restoring Americans' faith in their democracy. That seems like a weighty statement. What do you make of that when we talk about transparency and accountability and the need to restore Americans' faith in something as basic as democracy? true?
Sure. I mean, if the award was just for the drive-through dusty town halls, I would say, well, that seems like a lot of puffery, right? Are we really restoring anybody's? But the Management Foundation also acknowledged that this commitment to transparency and accountability permeates so much of what we do. You can find a lot of my House colleagues, their Twitter accounts, and you can see that most posts seemed designed in a lab to enrage people, to make them angry, to pit Americans against one another. And I think our course, we miss the mark periodically. We are far from perfect. But our goal is really more about engaging rather than enraging. And I think people really, I think the Management Foundation was touched by that. They love the fact that we respond to everybody who writes into our office and that we do so in such a timely way, in a far more timely fashion than most of my House colleagues. And they like the fact that every single week I call South Dakotans who write in. We take a subset. We get 5,000 letters and emails a month, so I can't call everybody back. But I make a point every single week of calling some back. And I think they just really felt like any of the thousands of South Dakotans, Lori, who are touched by any of those mechanisms over the course of the year was going to have a more positive interaction because of our additional efforts. And again, most of those efforts were done not by me, but you know, by a very dedicated team who also really believes in this.
We had a guest on the show this week who was struggling with not being able to contact us. Well, he could contact them, but his family was still in Afghanistan. He's worried about how long that might happen. Surely South Dakotans are reaching out to you with these kind of concerns. He asked me to forward that on to you. I sent it to you via Twitter. How does someone take a concern like that to their U.S. representative? Help people who are listening now and might want to reach you. What is the way to do it? And do you have any words for Salab today about the suffering that his family is going through?
Yeah, I think probably the most efficient way is to go to our website and type it in. People have a tendency to think when they go in, they type into these mechanisms that it just goes into a big black hole. But when you're typing in the information, then we know we've got all your contact stuff. We know your email and we know the details of the situation, and we can turn that around very quickly. Some people are more comfortable calling any of our four offices, Rapid City, Aberdeen, Sioux Falls, and D.C., and of course, that works too. This Afghanistan situation is really difficult. Amy, one of our dedicated staff, one of our senior caseworkers, was telling me just yesterday, Lori, though, about a success that we had gotten. You know, there have been a lot of South Dakotans who've called in and a lot of people in Afghanistan that we have not been able to help yet. But there are some of these cases where we have been able to make sure that somebody got the right email from the State Department and that they were able to make their way to the airport. And, you know, our caseworkers, sometimes their job is really difficult because they don't get to help everybody. And sometimes they have to tell people, they have to tell people no. But when you actually get a breakthrough and you can improve somebody's life, that fills up a bucket for a long time.
Congressman Dusty Johnson, we've been talking about his award from the Congressional Management Foundation for him and his staff. He was selected for achievement in the category of transparency and accountability, and he joined us from SDPP Studio in Rapid City. Thank you, Congressman. We appreciate your time.
Thanks, Lori.
Ahead on the program, we talk with SDPB's Richard Tubles about the continuing effort for COVID and clinical trials for booster shots. You're on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Politics and Public Policy Reporting is supported by the Center for Western Studies at Augustana University.
This week on Science Friday, alongside the pandemic, another crisis has been growing. Suicides in communities of color are becoming more common.
I think we're starting to realize that suicide is not just driven by psychiatric or mental illness factors. It has a lot to do with our environments.
Plus, we'll look at the ancient culture and current challenges of the orca. That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain.
Program funding by Art South Dakota, a catalyst for creative and artistic expression in communities and schools throughout South Dakota. Advancing the arts through education, service, and advocacy. More at artsouthdakota.org.
I don't think that after this year, I will continue to teach in my district.
Almost half of all new teachers will quit within their first 5 years. So states and even private companies have opened up more pathways to getting into the profession.
I did it online.
But many schools still face shortages.
The use of emergency certified teachers has become a new normal for Oklahoma schools.
Listen for Who Wants to Be a Teacher from APM Reports.
Listen Monday at noon Central, 11 a.m. Mountain on SDPB.
The exploration of cutting-edge products and services being offered in South Dakota is highlighted on our Science and Technology Beat, supported on SDPB by Black Hills Information Security. Diversity and Minority Affairs reporting on SDPB is supported by Rapid City Rotary Club and the family of Dr. Ashok Kumar.
You're listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Well, earlier this year, SDPB's Richard Tubbles talked with us about the Black Hills Center for American Indian Health and the work they've been doing to ease the symptoms of COVID-19 for Native Americans in the Rapid City area. Well, now Richard Tubbles joins me in SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City with an update. Welcome back, Richard.
Hey, thank you, Lori. Thanks for having me. How are you doing today?
I'm doing all right. It is the news just keeps rolling pretty fast, doesn't it, Richard? But we're still in the middle of a pandemic. So let's talk about how this work continues.
Yeah, it's coming in like a hurricane. So recently I talked with Dr. Jeff Henderson, who is he's enrolled in the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe. So he takes very a vested interest in Native Americans. And him and his organization, they had recently been involved in another research trial involving COVID-19 booster shots.
The only way we're going to know the answer to that question is to conduct research along that line that looks specifically at whether we need a booster for COVID-19. And at the American Indian Clinical Trials Research Network trial site, we are delighted to have been invited to participate in just such a trial. How well will it work, and will it protect us from developing COVID-19 down the road?
Hmm. All right, so now that they're into this new trial, Richard, how did the last trial we talked about proceed?
Well, according to Dr. Henderson, that first trial they did was pretty successful, and not only for participants, but proving that the vaccine was safe, well-tolerated, and cause very few allergic reactions. In fact, they have not had any participants test positive.
We found many of our relatives really living in extended family situations, multi-generational households, but really taking good care of one another. And everyone's come in masked, and they say they're distancing and washing their hands frequently, and not a single one yet has turned up positive. Despite lots of testing, we're looking for folks to turn positive, but no one has.
You know, in fact, Lori, their current trial for the booster shot is still open for enrollment, and it's open to everybody, Native and non-Native alike.
When we talk about a booster, you're already understanding that most people will come in here fully vaccinated, right? They would have been vaccinated with Pfizer or Moderna, two shots, or one shot of Johnson & Johnson. And that's true. This trial is looking for those people. However, importantly, even though it's called a COVID-19 booster trial, this trial is also looking for folks who remain unvaccinated.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. All right, I understand this trial itself is pretty promising. Tell me more.
Yes, it should maintain healthier Lakota and non-Lakota families. You know, Lori, as well as I do, there are people that have been severely affected by the coronavirus, and it can have a tremendous disruption on families and jobs and income, as well as, you know, the loss of life.
Many of our Lakota participants came into the trial site with a history of either they had COVID-19 in the past or multiple family members of theirs had COVID-19. You know, unfortunately, a few have the history where they lost a loved one because of COVID-19. But in each and every case, our people always wanted to learn more about how we could better protect and take care of one another. And, you know, at least with respect to COVID-19, you know, we feel that we can help them with that.
Richard, these medical professionals have not, they must be exhausted. And yet they are still coming up with new ways to get unvaccinated people in to get their shot, to treat people who have been infected and to research the next step. I just so much admiration for those healthcare workers as we continue on this path with our numbers rising in South Dakota, our new case numbers.
I think one of the biggest things that we talked about too with Dr. Henderson, you know, with the mandates of the mask policy, it's interesting the amount of influenza cases that went down.
Right.
You know, because our children are crazy spreaders of everything that could make us sick.
The petri dish of asthma attacks went down, you know, with some of the smoke that we've been seeing with wildfire smoke coming from Canada, coming from the West, coming from here in South Dakota and grass fires. The mask conversation is probably here to stay. As a parent of a daughter with asthma, it was remarkable to see her not struggle with that for so long. I also like what Dr. Henderson here had to say about families doing the simple act of taking care of each other, and perhaps we never get tired of that, right?
Definitely.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the SDPB studio at Red Cloud. How is that progressing equipment-wise?
Well, our studio is set up, and we have another portion that that's going in down there, not from ours, but from their end. And we're trying to get the AV equipment set up and the cameras, you know, the soundproofing and all that. And you know, once again, I can't stress how much I look forward to being down there. And you know, I plan to broadcast every Friday from down there live with you in the moment. I understand that you plan on coming to Best River to visit our studio, Lori.
Best River? Wait a minute. Yes, I'm excited to take in a moment out West River to see that studio and host the show from there. What a great opportunity. I look forward to that day. Richard Tubbles, thanks for all you're doing on that project, and thanks for bringing us this story today.
Yeah, thank you, Lori, for having me.
Ahead on the program, we are going to revisit the places that were underwater not so long ago and check in on a flooded landscape that is now impacted by drought. You're on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Health reporting on SDPB is supported by Monument Health.
Despite decades of training and billions of dollars spent, the Afghan National Army collapsed quickly, weakened by systemic issues like corruption, even illiteracy.
They don't know how to write, how to read.
Or how to be professional.
Professional
soldiers.
And leadership is very, very important.
The chronic challenges of the Afghan military, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen, beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB.
SDPB's Fiddles and Friends returns this August with 3 live concerts. Enjoy music from talented fiddlers including Kenny Putnam, Tom Schaefer, and Owen DeYoung. Join us in Watertown on August 26th, Sioux Falls on August 27th, or on August 28th in Rapid City. Help support SDPB and get your tickets today by going to sdpb.org/fiddles. Sponsored by Crisp Row Hospitality and First Bank and Trust.
Hi, this is Steve Inskeep with NPR, here to thank sustaining members of this station. Public Radio is here for you every day, no matter what. And when you give automatically every month, you continually show that you're here for us and for this community. Thank you so much for your support.
Monthly sustaining supporters form a strong foundation for SDPB. Sustaining donations are ones SDPB can count on to fund programs you love. Thank you.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. In the spring of 2019, severe flooding of South Dakota's rivers and streams wreaked havoc on fields, roads, and infrastructure. That spring, we talked with several farmers and producers about the rapid and destructive flooding on their land and in their communities. Today, we're checking in with two of those guests to see what has changed since the flooding of 2019. First, we welcome Kurt Ulmer from Menno in Hutchinson County. His operation is about 25 25 miles northwest of Yankton. When last we spoke, the National Weather Service had reported the Jim River near Scotland was at 18.35 feet. Today, it's at 3.57. Here is a bit from our first interview with Kurt Ulmer.
Our landscape is so saturated from the wet year we had in 2018, and we had such deep frost, it's heaved some of these roads so terribly bad, and there's so much moisture in these road beds. That's one of the things that really affects our area right now is the condition of our roads, all the flooding we had across our secondary roads, and of course then all that flooding ends up down in our river bottom areas where we, you know, it affects our livelihood down there.
Kurt Ulmer, welcome back to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Yes, I'm here.
Next, let's listen back to a bit of our conversation with Jennifer Strait. Her family's operation is between Murdo and White River near the convergence of the Little White and Big White. Millette County is almost completely under severe drought conditions today. Here she is in 2019 talking about how quickly the waters approached her home.
I had moved down here in 2011, and my husband and I were married in 12. So in all those years, I've never really even seen water come across our road. So in approximately, 20 to 25 minutes from the time my father-in-law came over and said, we need to move a car closer to the house, I just paid attention, and it moves quick. It's amazing, the power of water.
Jennifer Strait, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Maureen.
Kurt, let's talk with you first. Tell me a little bit about the impact the drought is having on your operations today. It's got to be a big change since the last time we talked, I'm guessing. Kurt Ulmer, can you? Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, okay, I'm on the air.
Yep.
Well, our pastures are in terrible condition. Our crops are drying up faster than I imagined. We started chopping silage at the beginning of the week, and we chop for a few of our neighbors and chop our own stuff. But most of the fields we've been in so far, we should have been in them 7 to 10 days ago, because the moisture of the corn is just, it isn't there. It's just dehydrating as it stands in the fields. And, the condition of our roads and all that, that's all gotten pretty good. If anything, we could use a little rain to help settle some dust.
You're right.
So,
My brother works outside, Kurt, and he works in irrigation, and he was just explaining how much dust gets in his ears and his eyes and his nostrils, and that dust is nothing to mess with. It can be difficult to work outside. What are some of the conditions as you do the work that you need to be doing with the heat and the dryness and the dust?
Well, I was in the cutter yesterday afternoon, and we had 5 trucks hauling. And when we would drive north with the wind, it was such a cloud of dust that it was hard to see sometimes where we were going almost. And it's just, when we had those wet years, I told my wife, I says, it's too wet now, and we know it's going to get too dry in a couple of years, whenever it happens, and we're at that point right now.
Yeah. Jennifer, how about with you? Some severe drought conditions in Millette County. How is it impacting your life right now?
Oh, we are just so dry right now, Lori. Basically, it's the puzzles that we're trying to put together all the time of where to move everything to at this point for livestock and how we're going to get enough feed. We're just struggling to get anything off of our fields for hay. We've had pretty much no alfalfa cuttings. I mean, we're looking at from going like 3 cuttings to, I don't even know if we really got one this year. It's just been so hard to know where things are coming from. And, like Kurt said, we had obviously so much moisture at that point in time in 2019, and now looking forward to wintertime for even next year, are we going to have enough moisture this winter to have any feed for next year? So it's just really a waiting game. I mean, I just feel like we're waiting for the water to go down. Now we're waiting for moisture, moving cattle around, looking for feed. It's been such an up and down. We were dropping off open cows yesterday at the livestock auction in Pier, and I noticed there are so many bulls there, and I assume people are pulling their bulls off of their pastures immediately as soon as the breeding season is done to try to get a little more feed for the animals they do have to keep through the winter time. So people are struggling right now to find feed. That's just a huge issue right now.
Really tough decisions. Kurt, talk a little bit more about livestock and some of the cattle and how you're thinking about making those choices, not fully knowing what's ahead.
Those are some good questions. You know, I relate this drought to 2012, and 12 was extremely dry by us, and we get several of our dugouts and dams that we use for watering our cows, they dried up, and we're in that same position right now. We're going to try and wean calves as early as we can so that we get them off the cow. And in the next week or two, we will have to start feeding our cows. There just isn't enough grass left.
Wow.
So I guess we do it a day by day, and we know the Lord will take care of us, but you kind of wonder what's going to happen. So,
yeah. Jennifer, one of the things I remember last year was, you know, how quickly the situation changed around your house and how quickly water surrounded you. Your husband couldn't get to you, and by the end of the day, he was kayaking to you to get to your family, and you were relying on the support of your in-laws. And so tell me a little bit about that family support, the community and neighbor support. How are you getting through this latest really difficult time? Yeah.
Oh, I feel like everyone is in the same boat. I mean, having the family around has been amazing. My father-in-law mostly farms, and he put in all wheat this year, so he's, you know, past that, and his wheat crop wasn't great either. But, you know, I think people are relying on their friends and neighbors, really, for feed. You know, everybody who has something is trying to make sure that, you know, hey, if I can spare anything at this point in time, I'll try. And but like a lot of us, we have no idea what's coming. I mean, it is a struggle to know, you know, those are great questions, but this could be a year and next year where we are just, we are going to have to rely on whatever we can get. I mean, we're fortunate because we had carryover. But a lot of people don't have that, you know, privilege of carryover. They're looking for hay and bales and, you know, anything they can get for feed at this point in time. I know pretty much everyone in our country has kept all of their straw off of all of their wheat fields, you know, just in case. I mean, that might be what it comes down to. You know, we really don't know. It's going to be tricky. But having family around is wonderful. We still obviously are, you know, right across the road from my in-laws, and I think we've had lots of inquiries to see just how much feed we have that's extra, and, you know, we have to conserve as much as we do, too. I don't know. It's going to be hard, Lori. These are it's hard questions, and I don't know if there's right answers for any of them, but we will certainly do our best to help out where we can.
Kurt, one of the questions I asked you last time was also about, you know, having that family talk. I think it's your daughter and son-in-law that have a place nearby. Do I remember that correctly? Mm-hmm. Or was it your son and daughter-in-law?
Yep.
Daughter and son-in-law. And at the time we talked, you said, yeah, we haven't really talked about some of those tough things yet. What are your family conversations like right now as you sort of, you know, navigate this next difficult thing?
Well, maybe we haven't talked enough about this stuff because we hope it'll go away, but it's not going to go away.
No.
You know, I'm getting closer to retirement age, and we do run about 250 cows, and my wife and me, we only have 50 of those out of the 250. So I know my son-in-law, he's talked to a couple neighbors if they have cornfields that they think aren't going to be worth harvesting. You know, we're going to try and buy them, chop them for silage, just to get through. But those river bottoms that were flooded so terribly bad in 18 and 19, we do have a good crop in those. We've got very good looking corn down in those bottom fields. And we planted every acre of them this spring.
Wow.
So that's going to help us a lot. You know, we're going to have stalks. We're going to have feed coming out of those fields.
Yeah. Kurt,
so that's the good side of river bottom.
Yeah. Can you plan at all for these weather extremes? Like, how hard is it? You know, we talk about, you know, climate resilient practices and the extreme weather conditions that we might expect in a changing climate. Can you plan for that from an infrastructure standpoint, from an operational standpoint?
Oh, boy. I don't know if you can. I would say that's pretty tough to plan.
Yeah.
To plan for a disaster. I mean, you know, it's the livestock guys that get hurt the most, because the crop farmers, they've got crop insurance to fall back on. And it's just a whole different ball game. There are some programs for livestock people, but you know, what do you do when hay should be costing, say, $80 to $100 a ton? And now hay is over $200 a ton. It gets to be an economic challenge to make that all work.
Wow. Kurt Ulmer and Jennifer Strait, I want to say thank you to both of you for checking in with us. I wish the news was better, but we'll keep reaching out to you now and then. And if there's anything, Jennifer, you want to leave us with, like, what do you want people in other parts of South Dakota to know about what's happening in some of these, you know, really drought-stricken areas?
You know, I feel like we've all been here before is the one thing I can say, and we've got through the other years. So I just want people to you know that we are very resilient, and we will do anything we can to make our livelihoods work. Our cattle are very precious to us. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, I wrote a post on Facebook just a few weeks ago, you know, just keep on keeping on. There's a lot worse things that could happen, so just try to keep your head up. It might be a while before it gets better, but it will.
Well, Jennifer Strait, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you, Lori.
Kurt Ulmer, be well. Thank you. Let's take a moment now for the SDPB August Spotlight to illuminate the Black Hills. We've been talking about the history of what is today widely known as the Black Hills National Forest. Well, what do people know about the forest before colonization, before commercialization? Let's hear more now from Craig Howe. He is founder and director of the Center for American Indian Research and Native Studies. Here he is talking about things that can't quite be measured or monetized in modern terms.
We know that a number of tribes have it in their memories of being in the Black Hills and in the Black Hills region from long, long, long time ago. And then from archaeological evidence, of course, we know that American Indian ancestors have been here for thousands of years, at least 9,000 years and probably closer to 12,000 years. So it's been known in the American Indian world for a long, long time, the Black Hills, and been stewarded by the people. From Lakota viewpoint, you know, their ancestors emerged into this world through a cave in what is now the Black Hills. And so that puts them here at the beginning, basically at the beginning of their time, of Lakota time. Well, we always say that was just a long, long time ago. We can't put a date to it. Lakota is called what we now call the Black Hills by two terms. Popularly, it's Paha Sapa and Te Sapa. And both of them mean basically black mountains. And it's because from a distance, when you're looking at the Black Hills, they have all those pines make it appear a real dark purple or a real dark green, just to black, you know. But in the literature, the early ethnographic literature, we can see where people referred to the Black Hills as a pack, like a food pack. I think our contemporary analog would be like Walmart, but it's this place where everything that people need for their sustenance can be found. And that starts from in the waters or the roots of plants to what's on the surface of the land, and then what's in the air, like in trees themselves and birds. and just the solitude of that place and the aesthetic beauty of specific places within that landscape. So it's this really encompassing place, a large area, you know, it's a huge area, but in that area is basically everything that people need to sustain themselves.
You can find all our August Spotlight coverage online at sdpb.org/spotlight. Ahead on the program, The Weight of the Catholic Conscience. Kevin Wooster joins us with thoughts about COVID, stem cells, and how he thinks about the nuances of a pro-life decision.
This week on Science Friday, alongside the pandemic, another crisis has been growing. Suicides in communities of color are becoming more common.
I think we're starting to realize that suicide is not just driven by psychiatric or mental illness factors. It has a lot to do with our environments.
Plus, we'll look at the ancient culture and current challenges of the orca. That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain.
Program funding by Denny Menholt Rapid Chevrolet in Rapid City, inviting you to experience the peace of mind and more that come with driving a certified vehicle from Denny Menholt Rapid Chevrolet. See you at Denny Menholt Rapid Chevrolet in Rapid City.
When you hear this music, does it make you optimistic about love or give you cold feet?
Lots of people argue that having these high expectations is problematic and it's harming the institution of marriage.
How marriage became so high stakes.
Most of what we think of as traditional marriage was not traditional at all, but a rather recent invention.
And what we can do to fix it on the next Hidden Brain from NPR.
Sunday evening at 6 Central, 5 Mountain on SDPB Radio.
Program funding by Arts South Dakota. It's growing season again for the arts and humanities. The American Rescue Plan is providing sizable federal grant funds to arts and humanities organizations across South Dakota. More at artssouthdakota.org/grants.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. When two South Dakota Catholic bishops speak, Catholics listen. But when the bishop of the Catholic Diocese in Rapid City and the bishop of the Catholic Diocese of Sioux Falls issued a joint statement saying COVID vaccinations are not what they called a universal moral duty, were they contradicting guidance from the Vatican? At issue, longtime ethical concerns among Catholics about the potential use of cell lines derived from decades-old elective abortions in vaccine development. To be clear, none of the available COVID vaccines contain any fetal cells or aborted fetal DNA as an ingredient. Kevin Wooster is a longtime journalist and Catholic who writes for SDPB online at sdpb.org/Wooster. I spoke with him yesterday about Catholic conscience.
So the bishops looked at these issues, and there's a question of moral conscience. And, you know, we discuss that all the time. Pope Francis discussed that all the time about the looking into yourself and trying to find in your conscience and in your prayer life what you feel comfortable doing and what you don't feel comfortable doing. And so the bishops were hearing from Catholics who don't feel comfortable taking these vaccines or are concerned about whether they should. The Catholic Church, starting with the Pope Francis, on down in an official sense, made that clear months ago that if there are no alternatives, these vaccines developed with these cell lines as part of the testing and development process, not as part of the actual vaccine, are okay to take. A Catholic can take that. And what is developed through this letter from the bishops implies that there is room for a religious exemption here, and that the Catholic in his true heart believes that he shouldn't or she shouldn't take these vaccines. That's appropriate, and there's moral and religious exemption should be available for that. And that got a discussion started because there have been many other Catholics, and there is a division on this among clerics, certainly, mm-hmm. not Pope Francis, he made it clear, in fact, he even said there's a moral obligation to take the vaccine because it's not only about you, but it's about your neighbor, it's about people across the world. And so there's the split, right? And I guess you could easily say that the split is divided between the very conservatives and the more progressive Catholics. But there's no question where Pope Francis comes down on it. So this is the issue that I took on, perhaps unwisely.
The Pope got his vaccine, right? The Pope is vaccinated?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Got it long ago. Pope Francis got it. Pope Emeritus Benedict got it. And Emeritus Benedict is certainly no progressive Catholic, I don't think people would say, but he got it. And the Pope strongly recommends and encourages people to get it. And so does our former bishop, Blaise Cupich, who's now the Cardinal of Chicago, Archdiocese of Chicago. He's Cardinal Cupich.
All right, so let me ask you this, Kevin, as a non-Catholic and speaking to a Catholic, how much does it matter what the Pope says and does and what the bishop says and does?
It matters. It matters to me. I don't agree with their conclusion on it, and that's why I wrote this, but their voice matters. I listen to those two men. I respect those two men. I as a Catholic, loves the Pope. I love my bishops and respect them, but I don't always agree with them. How much it matters is, well, it matters most of all, my argument always is, what the Pope believes, what the Pope does. Certainly what local bishops believe and what local parish priests believe, that matters. But the ultimate matter, in my mind, is what the Pope believes, and he's made it clear what he believes on this, and so have a lot of other upper-level Catholic clerics. But some of those, too, have gone the other way. And our bishops here were a lot more careful than a lot of bishops are in the way they phrased this and pointed out that there was some Vatican language that could lead you to believe there's no moral obligation here to take the vaccine. But Pope Francis has said in those words, Cardinal Dolan from the Archdiocese of New York, who's a very well-known Catholic and is no progressive. He was way too close to Donald Trump for my taste, but he's a big vaccine supporter and a promoter, has said the same thing, and Cupich has said it. So that's created some confusion in Catholic minds when you've got different voices. But so
let me ask you this then. A young Catholic comes to you and says, Kevin, what am I to do? And this goes back to your relationship with God and what you were speaking about earlier, that prayer time. What would your advice be to a young Catholic who says, I'm confused, I'm getting conflicting messages, what am I to do? What would you say?
Well, I would encourage him to go through a process of prayer and introspection, obviously, as part of his process or her process, to read the science, because many people forget the Catholic Church is really a science-based church and at its core. And Pope Francis is a huge believer in science, climate change, evolutionary issues. And in the end, I think Pope Francis speaks for the Church. There may be differing voices. He is the Church when he speaks. And so that would be my final word to the young Catholic is you have a lot of voices out there. The ones, many of those that I respect the most, including the largest, most important voice in the Church, that comes from the Vatican, from Pope Francis, has made his position clear. And I think, as Pope Francis says, we have an obligation to our neighbors across the street and around the world to take care of the common good. And that's the issue we're talking about here. And that doesn't mean you can't make your feelings known or say that you do it with a heavy heart, if that's how you do it. But I would obviously encourage the young Catholic to take the vaccine.
And for non-Catholics who would say, Kevin, this is hypocrisy in American religion to an extreme because people are going to die if you don't take this vaccine, and would be very critical of the Catholic Church, what would you say to that person?
Well, these are really difficult issues, and people have really strongly held beliefs and the church, for all of its many weaknesses in certain areas and sins in certain areas, crimes in certain areas, as we know, the church is strongly pro-life from conception to natural death, and I think it's been fairly consistent in that. So this is part of that, but pro-life, that, and that's one of the things I ask in there. When you say you're pro-life, you balance pro-life on abortions that were performed 50 years ago and used in testing, not in the actual vaccine, compared to actual living human children, moms, dads, grandpas, grandmas, and their lives on the line. What is more pro-life? I think the more pro-life choice in this question is fairly easy to discern. It is to take the vaccine and protect the fully formed children, moms, dads, grandpas, grandmas, and protect their lives. That is truly a pro-life decision in my mind.
You can read Kevin Wooster's work on our website at sdpb.org/Wooster. I'll spell that for you, W-O-S-T-E-R. Kevin Wooster writes On the Other Hand for Public Broadcasting. Thanks so much, Kevin. We appreciate your time.
Of course. My pleasure, Laura.
Music Matters is a digital series from SDPB and Levitt at the Falls. It explores the origins and inspirations of musical artists who grace the stage of the Levitt Shell this season in downtown Sioux Falls. Host Apollonia Davalos goes backstage, on stage, anywhere the music takes her to find out how and why music matters to our communities and to the featured artists. In this episode, which you can also find online, Davalos talks with Nerdy. Nerdy is actually a stage name for the eclectic hip-hop artist Matt Allen of the Twin Cities.
Today, we get familiar with the man, Nerdy. Hailing from Minneapolis, from pop culture punchlines to the power of positivity, Nerdy is a hip-hop artist giving nerd culture a voice. Using his platform to uplift his community at every turn, Music Matters is excited to join the Nerdy Club and present Nerdy.
Music can be positive and not happy. Being better the next day after hearing something is positive. It's like going to the gym or going to the doctor. Sometimes it's not fun. It's not like you're like, oh yay, you know, colonoscopy, let's get it. But it is something that you might need, and it's positive. And so when you have music that's honest, it allows you to deal with whatever the artist is wanting you to deal with, whatever emotion they're trying to portray. And anytime you're honest and vulnerable, that's a positive step. The genre of clean hip hop is a little different than what I would even have said even 3 years ago. I think that the idea of what people think about clean hip hop, they think of it as one that doesn't have cursing in it. The language is such that everyone can really kind of listen to it. But it's not devoid of a message. It's not devoid of the power or the oomph or even some of the harshness of hip hop. Hip hop was born out of struggle. Every single hip hop community was born out of some sort of struggle. It originated in the Bronx through black and brown people's struggle. Sometimes it can get a little gritty. It can get a little raw. It can get a little punchy. And that's not bad. It's not negative. And if anything, it's a real representation of how people are feeling. And clean hip hop is that, and sometimes it's just used in a way that if you have a little bit more of a sensibility to some of that stuff, some of the language that's used, it allows you to engage with that as well and can ease you into the wider world of hip hop that encompasses all sorts of language. And I think that's important to say. Well, an Easter egg is a term used for a little nugget of fun, interesting, or connected lore, or I don't know, I don't even have the word for it. It is an Easter egg. It is designed for that when you find it, you find something special. And it really is only there for the people who are looking for it. So when you're looking for an Easter egg, you're like, oh my gosh, I remember this from this. And in my music, I love to add little bits of Easter eggs. If you love Harry Potter, if you love Danny Phantom, if you're a big fan of the Big Bad Beetleborgs, you might hear something in my song. You'll be like, oh, that's from that. And that connection is what makes you light up, which makes me light up, and it creates a whole better experience than if you were just hear a really nice song. It's a little extra thing that lets me know and lets you know that we're on the same page. Today at the SuperCon event, we talked a little bit about something that I'm very passionate about, which is inclusivity in nerd culture. And the inclusion of other people, other cultures, other ideas, only make these stories better, not worse. It doesn't take away from what you love. It adds extra dimensions to it. Gatekeeping is a problem, and I think it's a problem based out of love, but it turns toxic really quickly. For example, someone like, oh, I like superheroes. Oh, really? Name every superhero. Like that, the response to try to have people prove whether or not they are worthy of being interested in something is not something, that's not how we get more people into the thing we love. Like, Blade really kicked off where we are now. Blade did incredibly well, and then they're like, oh, hey, maybe we can do superheroes again. And the story is people who are different and a little strange coming together or finding within themselves the strength to do something incredible. And it's up to us as people who've been fans for a very long time to take people in as opposed to try and keep people out. Like, let's teach them about the things that we love about it and hear why they might love some things about it. We might find a new aspect to a hobby or a music or a genre that we'd never known before. And I think that that's really cool. I think that's why we do this, because we like to find the little Easter egg that we might have not caught before. I love this stuff, but sometimes I don't always feel like it was designed for me in mind. But the reality is, when you talk about fiction and heroes and fantastical stories of magic, there is so much room for everybody in these stories. And as we continue to tell them, really start changing our culture, we can find space for everybody. Every color, creed, every age, every level of able body. Like, it is amazing how much the fantasy, the nerd world has for everybody. And so I just love talking about that. I love being able to share my heart on why it's important to focus in on that, because I don't want anyone to be left out on this marvelous, wonderful thing. If you have something that is amazing, if you have something that's unique, if you have something that's you, the Nerdy Club is here for you. And I want you to be a part of it, because it's too sweet. Brighter than the hate that tries to get in my way. Brighter than depression trying to get in my throat. Yeah, I think that's like the antidote.
Nerdy, thank you so much for just sharing how the nerd culture is literally for everyone.
That's right.
You literally brought us into the magic today.
That's what we do. We bring the magic for everyone. You get the magic. You get the magic. You back there, you also get the magic.
Episodes of Music Matters can be viewed on SDPB's Facebook page.